You made the tough and oftentimes scary decision to leave your abusive ex, but you share children with them, so it's not over. You are just at the beginning of the separation and divorce process. Does the thought of negotiating a parenting plan with your ex make you want to throw up? You're worried that you will freeze and let him walk all over you. Or maybe you're worried that if you set any boundary, then there will be serious repercussions. I need you to know how important it is to create a solid parenting plan where there is no wiggle room for your ex to exploit. Creating a loophole-free parenting plan can reduce ongoing conflict, can make communication and setting boundaries with your ex easier. It can reduce the ways in which your ex can bring you back to court over and over again, which is going to save you money and so much heartache. So I want you to join us for this free webinar, Creating Your Loophole-Free Parenting Plan, to learn the 5 strategies that we have seen work to help you protect you and your children through your parenting plan. Go to the link in the show notes to learn more and to register.
Then the woman has to get to a point where her case settles down, and it may settle down in a good place, a relatively good place, never seems to settle down in a great place, but it may settle down in a relatively good place, or it may settle down in a really bad place. But either way, it has sort of settled down and she has a little more space. The thing is, by that time, she tends to be just exhausted and just need a few years to like put herself back together, enjoy being alive. If the abuser hasn't succeeded in driving her children away from her, then she just wants to focus on having good time with her children. So in other words, when there's finally space in her life where she might really want to take action, she's got other things she needs to be doing. So both abused women and their allies really need to figure out how to give much more emotional support and much more activist training so that protective moms, as I refer to them, you know, abused moms who are having to co-parent with an ex, can have more space and energy to fight to change the system so that it doesn't just keep endlessly grinding up more abused women and grinding up more of their children.
Welcome to the Rising Beyond podcast, where you can find hope and healing after a toxic or abusive relationship. I'm Sybil Cummin, a licensed professional counselor specializing in working with victims and survivors of domestic violence and narcissistic abuse, including the youngest witnesses. Over the past decade, I have been honored to witness victims move to survivors and then to thriving in their lives. If you feel alone in your healing process, are dealing with the onslaught of post-separation abuse, or just needing some validation that you are not crazy, you are in the right place. Let's talk more about family court reform. And I'm not just talking about what laws need to be put in place for judges then to completely disregard later when they're making decisions. But what does it take to build a movement, one with momentum and sustainability? This episode is a follow-up to episode number 60, where I talk with Lundy Bancroft on the state of our current family court system and the passing of Caden's Law. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet, you might want to hit pause and go back to check that one out. It is episode 60. So today in this follow-up, Lundy and I are going to discuss what it's going to take to continue building momentum for positive change. So we're talking about strategies to support and protect the survivors and advocates that are on the front lines, and what really needs to happen to have more people really see and understand what is going on in our family court systems. And if you're not sure who Lundy Bancroft is, he is an advocate with over 30 years of experience here. He specialized in interventions for abusive men and their families. He's authored 7 books, including the world's bestseller on domestic violence, Why Does He Do That? and the prize-winning professional book as The Batterer as Parent. Lundy is a former training director of Emerge, the U.S.'s first counseling program for men who batter, and was involved in over 2,000 cases as a counselor and a clinical supervisor. He has served extensively as a custody evaluator, child abuse investigator, and expert witness. He has a new book that I talked about in the last episode called In Custody, A Cary Green Mystery. It's a novel, and it is one where domestic violence and the family law system are really illustrated in a novel form. So I hope you enjoy this interview. I love collaborating with him. We have just so much to talk about. So let's welcome Lundy Bancroft to another episode of the Rising Beyond podcast. Thank you, Lundy, so much for joining us again on the Rising Beyond podcast. I am so excited to have this conversation.
I'm looking forward to it too, Sybil. And the start that we got the last time I was on with you felt like a really good beginning place, but it felt like there was so much left to talk about.
Yeah, I feel like that's with almost any content in this arena, is that we can get started and then there's so much more. So today we are going to, again, kind of follow up on what we did in the previous interview on kind of how to make actual change in this space, in this arena. And we had left off last time with some of the changes that are happening, but then they kind of just die out. So what do you think is kind of needed to keep momentum going in the kind of social movement arena that we want to see happen?
So the first thing I'll say is one that I don't really have my heart set on, but I'm going to put it first just because it would be so unbelievably helpful if it could happen, which is I would really like to see the domestic violence programs develop a more of a social change and social justice mindset. Now those, which they had decades back. When domestic violence work first came to this country and there started to be all these different programs for abused women, those programs were very focused simultaneously on trying to make systemic change. They weren't just focused on trying to help their clients navigate specific bad situations. So And that has really largely disappeared from domestic violence work. Now the programs are more like social service agencies. They're just focused on the sort of one-by-one work. And they're attending a little bit to community education. They're not at all confrontational anymore. They've become very polite in the community, very polite politically. They don't want to ruffle feathers anymore. They don't want to upset funders anymore. And maybe that was the right thing to do at one time, I'm not sure, but it's not working now. It's not working now because funding is tending to be cut year after year. There's a lot of backlash against women. We live in a period of very heavy backlash against women. And so conditions for abused women are slipping in quite a number of ways, not just on the custody front, unfortunately. The custody front is where I find it most glaringly awful. But compared to the gains that the battered women's movement made so heavily in the 70s and 80s and 90s, the last 20 years have seen a lot of entrenchment and a lot of the system kind of taking things back and police going back to old ways of doing things and child welfare going back to old ways of doing things, which is blame the mom, blame the victim. So the number one role I would like to see the domestic violence programs playing is helping women find each other. That doesn't tend to be even any part of how they define what they do. It is actually bringing abused women together. They don't have gatherings much at all that will help women meet other abused women. They don't ask women, can I share your number with other women in our program who've had some similar experiences that you might like to meet? And the support group has become a much smaller part of domestic abuse services nationally. It hasn't disappeared, and some programs are still very committed to their support groups. But there are increasingly, in my experience, domestic violence programs across the country that don't even have support groups. They just do entirely one-on-one advocacy and say, well, you know, the women really want the one-on-one attention. And I'm not sure if that's entirely true, but in any event, I know from my decades of experience that women over and over again in speaking to me say that the support group was the thing that made the number one difference in their lives. And The support group is also how they then develop lasting relationships with other abused women so that they don't feel so isolated. They start to share emails and phone numbers. They start to communicate with each other. They start to get together socially to some extent. And this makes a huge difference in the lives of abused women. And then the next step is that I think domestic violence programs, domestic abuse programs, urgently need to offer support groups that are specifically for women who are in custody disputes, mm-hmm. and or who are just in any way dealing with ongoing co-parenting with an abusive ex, even if there isn't any litigation, because it's still incredibly stressful and difficult, even if in the absence of litigation. And this is a stretch right now for the domestic abuse programs, because that would feel kind of a little confrontational to them, but also because in the current atmosphere, they would feel obligated to allow men into those groups, men who defined as the victim, who are claiming that the mother is the one abusing them through the custody system. They would feel obligated to allow into those groups, and then it wouldn't work. I mean, those have to be, for a number of reasons, have to be women-only groups in order to feel safe for the moms, in order to keep abusers out of them, because abusers are so good at posing as the victim. I won't spend more time on that unless you want to come back to that. But
I'm like, that's amazing, because that is exactly what I do in the Rising Beyond community. So I'm like smiling over here, like bringing women together and and getting them support so they don't feel crazy and they're believed and they don't have to defend themselves 24/7. So I'm like, have a huge smile on my face over here.
Well, that's huge. And I'm really glad to hear that that's what you're doing. And I really applaud that. And then we really have to think about how do we develop women's leadership. And that's another thing I never hear from the domestic violence programs. They say, well, we're trying to help these women survive their circumstances. And of course, that comes first, and try to help them protect their children to the extent that they can. But I don't hear we're trying to develop these women into leaders. So there's still this kind of mindset of looking at abused women as these some kind of victim, which she is, but not because of who she is, only because of what happened to her. I mean, we've all been victims because of things that have happened to us at certain points. That doesn't mean that somehow that's our identity or who we are. And, you know, I've been talking to abused women for 30 years through my work, and I see leadership capacity all over the place. Not in every single person. Not everybody even wants to work in that kind of way, or at least not yet. But there's so much leadership capacity out there. And people, moms, need to learn, how do I facilitate a meeting? How do I manage a mailing list? How do we handle a protest? What do we do about wearing masks or whatever for people where they can't afford to have the judges see who the mom is, mm-hmm. right? Because judges become so retaliatory against mothers who protest publicly. How do you deal with, if you're trying to start a local group to fight for custody rights for abused mothers, how do you deal with people who are really disruptive or who are very attacking? And because this, anytime traumatized people try to work together to fight for their rights, they're going to be dealing with the fact that one of the ways that trauma plays out is that people start to attack one another rather than attacking the source of the trauma or the powerful people, you know, who's really responsible for mm-hmm. the trauma. They start to take it out on each other a lot. It's just the way trauma works, unfortunately. It's what we call the internalization of oppression. That oppression goes inside of us and becomes internalized. So then we start to take it out on each other instead of fighting the system that needs to change. So people who want to, women who want to do leadership need some help, some training in. So then how do we deal with people who are becoming very attacking towards each other? And so there's a bunch of skills that we need to have, writing skills. You know, how do you make a flyer? How do you construct an argument? These are things that people can learn. I mean, they're just skills. Yeah. Anyone who wants to be an activist needs some training as an activist. I'm not saying this is some special thing that protective mothers particularly need. It's that anybody who wants to take on activism. But I think the most effective social movements historically have been led by people who were enduring whatever the injustice was that the movement was fighting against. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're fighting labor struggles, workers have to primarily be at the front of those struggles or they start to lose. And actually, the labor movement is a great model for us of what to do and what not to do, and also of what not to do, because the labor movement more and more came under the control of people who weren't the kind of mainline workers, and that movement started to really let the workers down. Now, in the last 4 or 5 years, actual workers are starting to get much more control over their own unions again, and unions are starting to actually be a huge positive force for working class folks. And, you know, movements for welfare rights, really, when those were working well, was when poor people were the ones in the key positions of leadership, fighting for poor people's issues. And so, but this is also really a challenge. I forget if we talked about this last time, Sybil, or not, but moms who are in litigation, that's like, first of all, a full-time job just in itself.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's quite traumatizing. So she's got the trauma of what came before, and then she's got the trauma of what the system is doing, of what the family law system is doing to her. She's being re-traumatized. So she's just fighting like hell to try to keep her children well and to try to protect her relationship with the children from being poisoned by the abuser and by the court. So she's got a big job on her hands. And then, so if she can't be a leader about this stuff right now, oh, I forgot one thing I need to say, which is also she's got tremendous concerns about retaliation, including increasingly now judges are simply imposing a gag order where the woman's not allowed to discuss her case publicly. So then she's in contempt of court. I mean, I think those are completely unconstitutional, but she's in contempt of court, maybe. If she has one of those gag orders, then she's in contempt of court if she tries to fight publicly about what's happening, what the court is doing, at least to her personally. So there are a lot of obstacles, but there are women who in those circumstances nevertheless find ways to take public action, maybe under an assumed name, but sometimes even under their own name. But the other thing is that then the woman tends to get to a point where her case settles down, and it may settle down in a good place, a relatively good place. Never seems to settle down in a great place.
Yeah.
But it may settle down in a relatively good place, or it may settle down in a really bad place. But either way, it has sort of settled down, and she has a little more space. But the thing is, by that time, she tends to be just exhausted and just need a few years to, like, put herself back together, enjoy being alive. If the abuser hasn't succeeded in driving her children away from her, then she just wants to focus on having good time with her children. So when there's finally space in her life where she might really want to take action, she's got other things she needs to be doing. And so both abused women and their allies really need to figure out how to give much more emotional support and much more activist training, so that protective moms, as I refer to them, you know, abused moms who are having to co-parent with an ex, can have more space and energy to fight to change the system, so that it doesn't just keep endlessly grinding up more abused women and grinding up more of their children.
Yeah, because, right, it's like, and there's like that ebb and flow of, okay, so I have a downtime right now in my court case. 6 months later, a year later, oh, more motions are filed because of whatever, right? There's not always a reason. It's just more motions are filed. And so it is so hard. And so many of the women that I work with in the community or as clients is they're trying to fill their bucket of energy and, you know, time during those downtimes so that they have it stored up for when they know they're going to go back to court.
Yeah. So then another lesson I take from that, or another point I take from that, is that allies are really, really important to this movement. In other words, either people who haven't lived it or people who have lived it and are now really have had some peace from it, or it's been 10 years since or whatever. And so on the one hand, we really need to have protective moms at the forefront of the movement. But we also, a lot of other people need to help out, and a lot of people need to be there to support the leadership of mothers. And that means we need people who really respect the leadership potential of abused moms.
How do you think we can get more allies? So I get some, I guess, surprised looks, or people are surprised that I am not a survivor of. I came into this in a completely different way. I just didn't understand what was happening to the kids, because I'm a play therapist. And so the kids that I was working with, I was like, what is going on in family court? Like, this is so stupid. And so I came at it from a different way, but I have found that it's hard to get people on board to be as loud as I am willing to be. And they don't have to be as loud as I am, but yeah, it's just been really hard, I think, to find allies that are not survivors that are going to put kind of all in to this.
I mean, my experience is that you always tend to get more motivated people from people who've lived it. But I've actually ran into quite a number of people who care a great deal about this issue who have not lived it. And what I feel like is most necessary is a clear thing to ask someone to do. Because now if someone's like, oh, my God, I can't believe what you're telling me. And which is often the reaction of people who learn what's going on in the family court. I don't hear a lot of people defend the family courts.
Yeah.
Now, occasionally I do. But, you know, one thing I say about this issue is this isn't really one we tend to have to convince people on. We just have to inform them because they usually have no idea it's happening.
Yeah.
But once they know it's happening, they're not like, well, you know, 80% of people, I just made that statistic up, but, you know, some huge number of people are on our side once they actually realize what's going on there. It's very hard to say, well, what could you do?
Yeah.
So I see a real urgency to try to create ideally a unified national organization or two or three, it doesn't have to be one necessarily, but mm-hmm. a thing where you can say, here's where to go plug in. And you can send the money, you can start, and people want to do more than send money though. So here's how you can start a local chapter. Here are some ideas about specific actions you can take in your town. Here's to start to protest at your court, which is the main thing I want to see happening is people starting to protest at their county court. And the main place currently that I can send people to is California based. I'm not in California, I'm on the East Coast.
Yeah.
But the Center for Judicial Excellence is really so far the national model for how to create a really strong, effective organization. And they do national work, but their focus is California. They're an outstanding organization. I really encourage people to check out the Center for Judicial Excellence, Kathleen Russell's organization, just amazing. But we really need something like that on a national scale or multiple things like the Center for Judicial Excellence, you know, one in every state or whatever, but something that's where it's much more clear that, you know, there's a group in Connecticut that's working on starting a group called Mothers on the Rise. I think I probably mentioned that last time. Mm-hmm. Very much in the early stages, but it's, you know, another model of trying to focus on really grassroots building, because we have to get way more numbers involved. And people, I mean, we can talk about this more today, but people jump, I think, too quickly to like try to fix the situation by passing a law, hoping that that'll force judges to start to do better. And it doesn't end up doing having the kind of impact that we hope that it will have, because we have not built our numbers up enough. So we have to have way more chapters of our organizations, way more involved moms, way more involved allies, so that we're really building a movement. And that's going to take a lot of county by county, court by court organizing. It's going to take time and it's going to take work, but that's how you get power to actually make a system change, because family law judges just ignore the law whenever they want to ignore the law. They have almost complete impunity.
Yeah. I don't know if recently is the right word, but have been a part of the National Safe Parents Organization, which is kind of doing, right, they've started doing smaller state by state. So there's a Colorado chapter, but right, the numbers aren't huge yet. But I think that there are some groups that are starting these groups, because I think survivors are starting to see, wow, we do need more numbers. And then they actually, when you look at the statistics, we have a ton of numbers that could be a part of these organizations. But it's like putting the links out there, like, here's how you join, here's what we stand for, and getting that to the masses.
And I think we have to get very, very clear about what we are demanding, because what I see happen a lot is efforts to create standards where judges have to participate in a certain amount of training of a certain kind. And I don't think that's a good place to put our energy, because our problem is not lack of training for judges. Our problem is an actively bad agenda among judges. And training does not change a person who has an actively bad agenda. There are family court judges who make some mistakes just out of lack of training, but they don't make the size of mistakes that the other judges are making. They don't insist year after year on being horrible to protective mothers.
Yeah.
But, you know, they make some judgment errors, but they're not the problem. So the group of judges that's kind of trainable is first of all, a fairly small percentage, and I've done a lot of training for not just for judges in general, I've done a lot of training for family law judges in more than a dozen states in the U.S., and the uptake was very, very limited. And I'm very friendly and polite when I'm talking to judges. I don't say the kind of things I'm saying on this podcast. And so it's not because I'm like rude or anything. They really don't. The great majority of judges have an actively bad agenda. They don't want to change what they're doing. They don't want to change the way they're thinking. And they, somebody like me who is so knowledgeable, they just decide I don't know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so putting our energy towards demanding training standards for judges, I think, is a mistake. And I wouldn't put much energy there. And I wouldn't put a lot of energy into passing laws. Where I would tend to put energy specifically is into a really concrete, specific set of demands about things like the judges may not impose gag orders, that the family court has to develop a set of a protocol for how it will deal with domestic violence allegations and sexual abuse allegations in a custody battle that requires them to take entirely specific steps.
Mm-hmm.
It says the judge must do this every time these kinds of allegations arise. And people say, well, there's lots of false allegations out there. Well, those people, they're wrong. But those people should be in favor of exactly the same protocol.
Right.
Because that would protect them too. The people who are genuinely falsely accused. Doesn't seem to be a lot of people, but it does happen. To demand that billing, parent coordinators, custody evaluators, guardians ad litem, so forth, cannot bill the parents. They have to bill the court, and the court has to bill the parents. What that would do is make it so that the court had to be aware of every penny that the parents were spending and how much these people were charging per hour, because people now will get charged $15,000 by a custody evaluator or $10,000 by a parent coordinator. Court doesn't even know if that's what they've been charged. So anyhow, I made up a list of these. I'd be happy to share these with you, Sybil, if I didn't
that would
already.
Be awesome.
That's like, here is exactly what we should be demanding that I think would make us much more effective in it. Because if people are forming chapters like the National Safe Parents Organization, that's great. I would love to see, like I say, a model like the Center for Judicial Excellence really spreading, or Mothers on the Rise really spreading. But if we're going to end up really focused on passing laws or focused on demanding more training for judges, I think we're going to put so much energy in the wrong direction. Some small good things will come out of that, but the kinds of changes that we desperately need are not going to come out of that.
Yeah, and I think to your point of we need to really specify what we're asking people to do, I see that. So I do, again, legislative kind of advocacy for domestic violence and family court stuff, but I also do it for Medicaid reform here in Colorado because we, you know, people need to have good access to care no matter their income. And what I have seen is I don't know what to do. I show up and I'll talk about what I think, but a lot of people are so uncomfortable doing that. And so what we've seen really work is having the template email that you're sending to your legislator or the template, like these are the things that we can send, like you can do this exact thing that doesn't take a whole lot of effort initially to do. And so there's different levels of things, but the more clear we are about what someone can do, like what's their next step, the more engagement we've had. If we kind of leave it up to people and be like, oh, you should come testify at this hearing. There's just a handful of us in that regard that do that. I will say for the Cadence Law stuff, we were there for hours and hours and hours and hours because a lot of people showed up then, but a lot of people don't know what to do. They just don't know that next step. So having really clear steps would be so helpful.
And one thing I've noticed also is that there've been over my years in the field, and I've been in domestic abuse for 30 years now, but for probably 20 of those, there's been widespread awareness of what's happening to abused women in the custody system and widespread distress, upset about what's happening to abused women in the custody system. There've been some national conferences on abused women in child custody. And there was an annual conference, a Bad Mothers Custody Conference in Albany, New York, that people come from all over the country to and abroad. Mm-hmm. But there's never been a conference where the whole conference was about movement building. And that's not what the Battered Mothers Custody Conference focuses on. It really focuses on how, again, mostly on how to help people deal with their particular cases and helping educate the public about the issue, which is great. I mean, that Battered Mother Custody Conference has been an incredibly positive force. So I'm not complaining about what they're doing in any way. I'm just saying this is a piece that hasn't been done. And if we could pull people together, what this might maybe what we should try to do is go, because there are some activist-oriented foundations that really like to fund activism, to see if we could get a national conference funded, except not a conference, a training. And I'd be happy to be the main trainer at the thing and get people there for ideally 3 or even 4 days, survivors and allies, and train them in like all these different skills that I just listed off. And then you just listed off another key one, which is public speaking and testifying type of skills. And I think we could come out of a 3-day training like that, ready to split off in all our different directions and create structures where then people who wanted to plug in, we would know how to plug them in.
Yeah, because I do think that we have a lot of big picture thinking out there about how to do it, but it's that like systematization. Is that a real word? I don't know. I made it up.
That is a real word.
Okay.
Yes. That is a real word.
Of how we are doing the thing, right? These processes is definitely where I think there's kind of the gaps. I was just thinking as you were talking too, is how important do you feel like media is in this push?
I feel like it's very important, but at the same time, I feel like it's important not to start to try too hard to please the media or start to feel like it's only worth doing if we get the right media response. And this is a mistake that I think activists make in general, not just around this issue, but of planning like a picket or a march or a demonstration with the hope that that'll get media coverage and then feeling like the day was a success or a failure based on whether it got enough media coverage and good, you know, positive media coverage or not. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we want to put that much power in the hands of the media, especially because the media is inherently very conservative. And I don't necessarily mean conservative in the liberal conservative thing, but I mean conservative in the sense of tries to play things pretty safe. So yes, we want to build good relationships with the media. We want to learn skills for how to talk to reporters, how to write press releases. Those are really valuable skills for people. We really want to take video at our events when the participants are safe with that. Sometimes the participants need to not be on anybody's video, but when it's safe, we want to take video of our events and have those up on Facebook and places like that and really learn how to use both conventional media and social media, I think are really important. But I think we also want to try to find strategies for our protests that aren't dependent on whether the media covers it or not. So to me, if you're planning a picket or a march, you should figure out how to make that an effective event, even if the media don't cover it at all. Mm-hmm. And that requires sometimes some different thinking about what's going to make an action an effective action.
Yeah, because I think media is helpful and sometimes the only way to get people to look or listen or take us seriously. I know in Colorado, we've had some pretty poor media, which was helpful in getting it out there, right? Like putting it in more of the public's eye. And media is fickle, so they're not always interested in what we have to say because there's going to be something more interesting potentially out there in that moment. So I see that sometimes it is amazingly helpful to have kind of your advocates within media and have it put out there. And yeah, it's so hard because it's like you can't always count on that being present for you.
And nowadays, there are people who are just so skilled at how to bring attention to something through social media that if you get somebody like that involved with your group, it's an immediate boost to your group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so sad that one of the only ways that we got, and not here in Colorado, it didn't really affect us here, but in California with Pinky's Law is because the kids who have experienced the reunification camps are the ones talking, and they're the ones that were on social media. And that is heartbreaking, so heartbreaking and powerful because they're the ones that experienced it. But I think that brought so much attention to what they were trying to do there. But man, it was, it's just heartbreaking that our kids are going to have to do this to get any movement, I guess.
And actually, I didn't even talk about that, about leadership from these courageous kids themselves. And I do think that's very powerful. And also, what you just said reminded me of another thing, which is that I think that from an organizing standpoint, we're going to tend to do best by first emphasizing the absolute worst things that are happening. Mm-hmm. And like, I think that bringing in coercive control laws is a really interesting project, and it's potentially helpful in the long term. But really, the motivation, as I understand it, behind bringing in coercive control laws is the concern that the system is missing a lot of the subtleties, which it certainly is. But yeah. I feel like, yeah, they're missing a lot of the subtleties, and they're missing the most gross hit you over the head stuff, never mind the subtleties. So in some ways, I feel like, well, let's not worry too much about getting them to recognize the subtleties until they, when we can't even get them to recognize the outright obvious rapist,
yeah,
father, you know, it's like, so those reunification camps are so egregious, mm-hmm, that it's a really good issue, I think, for people to latch onto across the continent and use as an organizing tool. And of course, some states are going to say, well, nothing like that's going on around here. And then we have to say, this stuff always spreads. If it's here, it's coming to you after a while. But other examples, it's not just the reunification.
Yeah.
There are other,
yeah,
things where we can focus on, here are the most outrageous. Let's look at what's happened in these most outrageous cases. And when people say, well, those are outliers, we say, if those kinds of things can't be prevented, what do you think is going on in other cases? Like,
yeah,
you're kidding yourself if you think that the outliers don't matter. The outliers tell you everything about what's going on in a, quote, ordinary case.
Yeah. Yeah. So in Colorado, we have a judge who has now overseen, I think she's a magistrate, overseen two child fatalities that were pretty, right? You don't even have to be a therapist that specializes in this to see it, right? I feel like anyone reading the court case info would be like, oh my gosh, that guy's not safe. And so under the same magistrate, two fatalities, and is she canned? No, she's not canned. She switched to a new county, right? So what the heck?
In my book, In Custody, I wrote a bunch about the Katie Tagle case in California. And if people want to say, oh, well, that judge was just crazy, she was before three different judges in three different places who all, and she related to what you were just saying, Sybil, the evidence in her case was the kind of thing where anybody would look at this and think, somebody's going to be dead tomorrow.
Yeah.
This boy, Katie Tagle's boy, is going to be dead tomorrow. Anybody who looked at, any reasonable person who looked at this would say, this boy's going to be dead any day. And yet three different judges there say to her, oh, well, you're way overreacting. And even though she's like handing them this overwhelming evidence,
yeah,
and actually that guy was never removed by administrative action. They had to run the one who was the worst judge in Katie Tagle's case. They had to run somebody against him because it was a county where the judges are elected, and they had to defeat him electorally.
Yeah,
publicizing what he had done in Katie Tagle's case, but so those kinds of things also. I think we have to try to really focus on publicizing with the judge's name on it. So that when you're talking about this judge that's been responsible for two different fatalities, like, people need to seize on that kind of thing, put photos up of her all over the place. There was this action that mothers led in New York long, long ago, more than 10 years ago, where they all printed up T-shirts that had the judge's face on the T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those kinds of actions to really bring it home what these people are doing. The international movement for human rights, which is, you know, a movement that's been growing for decades, the main tactic of that movement is, I shouldn't say the main, but one of the outstanding tactics of that movement is public exposure. What they're very,
yeah,
heavily focused on is anyone who's working from a position of power and doing horrible things, we're going to expose them personally. Mm-hmm. And that, so we really have to bring that to our fight against these family law atrocities. And the mother herself is not usually going to be the one who can do that, because she's going to get punished so severely if she does.
Yeah.
So it's going to require, you know, moms who are not from her case, and especially going to require allies to really start publicly blowing the whistle on what these individual judges are doing. My experience is one of the only things that I've seen successfully change judicial behavior on any issue is seeing other judges publicly exposed.
Yeah. And what's so interesting is like this parallel process, right? Of like, what is the thing you can do to someone who is abusive and narcissistic is you remove the mask and you show who they are publicly. And I'm like, oh, look at that. We're doing the same thing to these family court judges.
In my book, Why Does He Do That? I talk about what I call power mongers. That's not a term I invented, but you have a class of people. Fortunately, I think they're quite a small minority of human beings, but you have this kind of class of people who are just love power, and they love to mm-hmm. abuse that power. And men who abuse women are in that category. They're power mongers. And the thing is, power mongers, either consciously or unconsciously, I think it's largely unconsciously, recognize each other and are drawn to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So a judge who's faced with an abuser and an abused woman, his or her gut sympathies are going to go to the perpetrator, not towards the victim, because that's the person who's going to feel similar to the power mongering judge. And there are unfortunately so many power mongering judges out there, and they seem to particularly find their way onto the family law bench. And I think it's because they don't have juries there.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The judge just has the most unbelievable power in the family law context. Judges and magistrates just, they can do almost anything they want, and almost nothing can be done about it. And so it attracts power mongers, or maybe it turns some judges into power mongers that weren't even power mongers before.
Mm-hmm.
That ancient saying about how power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely is so applicable to what goes on in the family law context. And so the parallel that you're talking about the exposing of the abuser and the exposing of the judge, to me, it's not coincidental. It's parallel because they're both power mongers, and power mongers yeah. recognize each other, back each other up. Sometimes they also compete with each other in certain contexts, but whenever it's in their interest to back each other up, they're backing each other up, and they're feeling sympathetic to each other. Like, when the abuser starts to say, I'm such a nice guy, and I'm so sick of having all these unfair accusations at me that I'm abusive, the judge thinks, God, I so relate to that, because mm-hmm. I'm so sick of people accusing me of being way into power when I'm just such a sweet, loving man or such a sweet, loving woman. And so that sense of like being falsely accused of being awful, they're immediately bonding around.
Yeah.
Of course, the worse the judge is, the more the judge has been bitterly complained about and resents having been bitterly complained about.
Yeah. And then we wonder, well, I don't wonder, I bet you don't wonder, but why survivors of this have such a hard time trusting anyone, right? Like, because the person that's supposed to protect them, the law enforcement, that also a lot of them are in that power monger crew, right? They're not protecting the attorneys. A lot of times are not protecting, the judges are not protecting, like they are running into this everywhere they go. So yeah, they have nowhere or no one to trust. At least that's, you know, in their experience, even though there are many of us that they can trust, and not the ones right in front of them, right in front of them.
Right. And also because people overall so fundamentally believe in the fairness of our judicial system, that it's very hard for them to accept, unless you give them a lot of detailed information, that they could be doing things that are that outrageous. Mm-hmm. So they just want to think, well, this mom, there must be something going on with her. And then the abuser tends to be very persuasive. So a lot of times she's also been burned by her own close people. Sometimes her own yeah. family has yeah. sided with him. Sometimes some of her best friends have ended up siding with him, or her church, you know, over and over again, women tell me stories where their church has sided with him. So you know, I'm always saying to women, hey, you will be able to trust again someday. If it takes you a long time, that's natural that it's going to take you a long time.
Yeah.
To be able to trust people again after being burned that royally, of course it's going to take you a long time to trust again.
Right. And there's nothing wrong with you. This is like a normal experience to such a horrific and abnormal situation.
A normal reaction, right?
Like your inability to trust fits. It makes all the sense in the world because of what you've been through.
And I always say to women, don't feel obligated to trust someone because they say they're trustworthy. Make them earn your trust. You know, you've got good reason. I mean, I think that probably applies to everybody, but it applies extra to people who've been burned that badly. It's like, don't trust anyone until they've earned your trust. You have that right.
Yeah. So what, as we're kind of wrapping up, what can we do or what do you see is really needed for that ongoing support? Because I think that the way our system is set up, right? I'm a therapist. And if you're doing things kind of the therapy medical model, which is just how things are set up with insurance and things, help seems time limited a lot of the times. And finding support that is this ongoing support throughout the healing process, the family court process, that's just harder to find. What else, I guess, what else do you see that we could do as allies or support or survivors who are past the stage where they are consistently triggered, their nervous system is consistently a wreck? What can we do to support people that are going to jump in to more advocacy?
So first, I would say, let's start demanding that domestic abuse programs offer support groups that are specifically for moms that are having to co-parent with an abusive ex, you know, whether they're in litigation or not. So that there could be more emotional support and companionship for abused women would be great. And then the idea of taking something like the National Safe Parents Organization or Center for Judicial Excellence or Mothers on the Rise and trying to form county by county or at least state by state chapters. But really, I think county by county would be ideal because you have to focus on protesting what's going on at a particular court. And
yeah.
So we need to create a set of materials. Mothers on the Rise has started to do this. That's like how to start a group and how, here are some of the things you could work on and here are some policy demands to make. We have a whole little packet. I'm happy to share it with you, but it's still very much in the development stages. I say we because I've been trying to help Mothers on the Rise out. I think it would be great to have a conversation with Kathleen Russell at the Center for Judicial Excellence. I've never done this because it didn't really pop into my head until my conversation with you today, Sybil, is to ask them, oh, would your organization, could it somehow be chapterized? Like, could people start chapters of the Center for Judicial Excellence? Or if that wouldn't make sense, you know, what would Kathleen recommend for how we spawn these things a lot of different places so that people would have a place to plug in? And then I think, as I say, really getting very clear on what our strategy is, I think would really help people, would really help. Let's keep thinking about what are some other ways that we could have a sort of national strategy discussion, because I've seen a lot of people get motivated on this issue and then we lose them after a while because of the partly needing more organization as we're discussing, but also needing kind of more focus. Like, what exactly are we demanding?
Yeah.
And so I would love to see us close in on that a little bit. Sue Shatney, who's Mothers on the Rise in Connecticut, I would really encourage having her part of the discussion. Is there someone who's sort of the driving force behind the National Safe Parent Organization? Do you know?
There are, and I don't want to misspeak because, again, it's one of the situations where people reach out to me and they're like, hey, you should do this. I'm like, great. Okay. And so I just do it. So I don't have the connection, although it's pretty easy to have that connection. But if you are listening and you're like, oh my gosh, I need to know these places and these things, they will be in the show notes. We're going to put links to all the things in the show notes so that you can find your state. You can join. You can check out to see if these fit how you want to work within this space. Because we do, I think her name's Danielle, but I can't even remember her last name right now. So I'm sorry, Danielle. I will put the right last name in our show notes. Because I think that is important to have people come together. And even if, and here I put this because, and this would be a whole nother episode, so we can't jump into it, but even if the kind of leaders or heads of these groups don't 100% agree. We still need to come together on the things we agree on. That's like my own soapbox. And so that's a whole nother episode that I could rant on forever. So we don't have time to do that right now. But that I think is really important as we're fighting this, is to really see where are our commonalities? What can we agree on? Let's make some change there.
I totally agree. And like pretty much every other social movement that I've been part of, the movement for custody rights for protective moms has just had so many divisions and so many, you know, this person isn't speaking to that person anymore kind of stuff. And some of it's for very good reason. I mean, I do think we have to have standards that people about how we're willing to be treated.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so much what the whole movement is about, right? Is about saying, no,
yeah.
I can't be treated that way. But at the same time, we also have to find ways, as you're saying, to continue to collaborate on whatever we can collaborate on and in pursuit of the goals wherever we can agree. And I think there are such huge areas where I think we'll be able to get very wide consensus. You know, I think pretty much everyone's going to say there shouldn't be gag orders, and pretty much everyone's going to say there shouldn't be reunification camps, and pretty much everyone's going to say a judge shouldn't be allowed to just decide that domestic violence allegations are false or decide that sexual abuse allegations are false without having taken any of the proper steps for how you investigate those kinds of allegations, for how you investigate and evaluate those kinds of allegations. Those kinds of I prefer to call them disclosures, actually. I've been referring to them as allegations today, but that term bothers me because as soon as you hear the term allegation, you think of it a certain way.
Like, oh, it might not be true.
Since we know that the vast majority of these are true and that only a very small percentage are untrue, I think it's much better to refer to them as disclosures.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's lots of work to do. You're going to create this amazing conference. It's going to be great. I'm going to be there too. We're going to invite everyone to be at our conference.
Training.
And we're going to find someone that's going to pay for it. It's going to be great. It's going to be great. We're going to do this training. It's going to be amazing.
Let's do it. You can do it in Colorado. Colorado would be a good place to have it. So.
Yes. Like, let's do it somewhere pretty in the mountains. Let's do that. So, well, Lundy, thank you so much. I think, again, I am always grateful that you're willing to hop on with me and have the conversations. Not everyone is willing to have the really honest, kind of in-depth look at this, kind of. Either people just want to go to the ugly, like the really ugly, in your face ugly, or they want to go to like more rainbows and butterflies and things are changing. And it's like, we got to be all in there with all of it because there's some great things happening and there's some ugly. So I appreciate you.
Well, thanks so much for the work that you're doing. And you're a huge help to me in helping me articulate the key points. So this also really helps me put my own thinking together. And that should help me contribute to kind of putting packages of information together in ways that I think would be most helpful.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you. And thank you all for joining us on this episode of the Rising Beyond podcast. If you are wondering how to get involved, you can go to the show notes, but you can also send me an email. I respond to all of them, info@risingbeyondpc.com. And we will catch you on the next episode.
If you found hope and support through this podcast, there are a few things you can do to help us continue to provide meaningful and value-packed episodes. First, you can follow and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you're willing, while you're there, you can give us a rating and review, which will help other survivors find us so we can offer them this help as well. And if you have the means and desire to do so, you can click on the Buy Me a Coffee link and help provide a small financial contribution to the show. This allows us to spend more time and energy finding the best guests and providing the most value to you. And if you want to work with me and the Rising Beyond community, go to www.risingbeyondpc.com for details.